for the opportunity to speak once more to the New York local, which I spoke to for the first time nearly 25 years ago. The theme of my speech this afternoon is the history of the party, the falsification of party history, the political meaning of Cochranism and its social base, and the perspectives of the party struggle. The history of our party is the history of a consistent and uninterrupted fight for the program and perspective of the coming socialist revolution in the United States, without once making a single concession to American imperialism or to Stalinism, the two enemies we started out to fight 25 years ago. This year, we will celebrate the 25th anniversary of our party. And we can do it proudly, because there is not one single stain on our banner. I am here today to defend the 25-year record of our party and the leadership which has shaped and directed it from the beginning in unbroken continuity for a quarter of a century. I am here to defend that record against any attack from any source. At the 1946 convention of the party, our revolutionary program and perspective were formally stated in the theses on the American Revolution. We defend these theses against any opponents from any quarter as the programmatic guide of the party in its struggle against American imperialism. Within the framework of endorsement of our 25-year record and agreement on the theses on the American Revolution, we have had differences of opinion in the past on this or that proposal or action. We will no doubt have other such disagreements in the future. We have discussed these differences in a fraternal way and eventually resolved them. We never fought anybody. We never split with anybody, except those who challenged the program and perspective and the record of the party in serving that program and perspective, and deserted the party because they no longer wanted to belong to it. That will be the case also in the future, I am sure. And how can it be otherwise? Genuine revolutionists, hemmed in by a world of enemies, are privileged to differ and debate among themselves. They are not privileged to fight and to split. The party has always permitted differences of opinion and has never expelled anybody, not one single person, because of his opinion. But we have to remember that the Socialist Workers' Party is a revolutionary party and never pretended to be anything else and never asked anybody to join it on any other basis. And we try to keep people in the party on that basis. And as long as they remain revolutionists, they love the party and stay in the party and never think of leaving the party. But when they cease to be revolutionists, as some have in the past, we noted invariably that their attitude undergoes a complete and profound change toward the party. They begin to hate the party. The party becomes a prison for them, and they insist on breaking out, as many have done in the past. Revolutionary party. If you want to know the real reason, and I have been told that there has been talk of split in the New York discussion. We did have a split in 1940, as some of you remember. But it couldn't be helped. There was a fundamental reason for it. Burnham was a sick man when he took up arms against the party in 1939 and induced his dupe, Shachtman, to join him in the split in 1940. Burnham was a sick man. He had a bad case of Stalinophobia, which is the starting point of social patriotism in modern times. I think he also had a touch of cannon phobia, but I didn't really hold that against him because I gave him plenty to froth at the mouth about before I got through with him. Our fundamental explanation of the 1939-40 fight, made at the time, not at the beginning, but in the course of the fight, has been confirmed to the hilt by the subsequent evolution of the contending factions. Burnham openly joined the imperialist camp within a few months after he split from our party. The Shachtmanites went through a slower evolution, but they also arrived at the position of social patriotism, masked by the formula of the third camp, and that's where they are today, in the third camp of social patriotism. Both sides in the present conflict seem to recognize that this conflict also cries out for a fundamental explanation. Nothing less will do. If Trotsky was right when he said in 1939, that every serious faction struggle in the party is, in the final analysis, a reflection of the class struggle, and I think he was right, and if the seriousness of the present fight is to be measured by its intensity, by its factional antagonism and animosity, which comrades have described to me as frenzy at least in New York. If that is the case, then it seems to me that it is high time to pass over from the discussion of incidents, details, and secondary matters to a consideration of Trotsky's formula of 1939 and to ask, what is the basic cause of all this factional frenzy that has seized the organization in New York? What is the cause of this open talk of split? What class forces are contending here, and who represents which? The document of the Cochranites, which is called, I think, the roots of the party crisis, but which ought to be called the 1943 edition of the war and bureaucratic conservatism. This document gives one answer which I will consider. My answer to the basic causes of the conflict is different, and I will explain why. Their document says, and I quote, "Behind the present struggle is the shadow of the Third World War." That's correct, but it doesn't help much. It is merely a statement of fact, the same statement that was made in the war and bureaucratic conservatism. It's a statement of fact which nobody can deny. But the world situation at the moment did not fall from the sky. It grew out of a long chain of preceding circumstances, which we are accustomed to cite and to analyze in explaining the present world crisis, which is due to explode in war and revolution. The present party crisis didn't fall from the sky either. It also has grown up out of preceding events and objective circumstances, the accumulated effect of which is the factional explosion. These preceding and causative objective factors ought to be considered at the present time. When they are added up together in all their accumulated power and immensity, their effect on the party, registered by the factional conflict, loses all element of surprise. The surprise is only that the party crisis didn't come sooner and strike deeper. I personally think that the subjective factor, the factor of leadership, had a lot to do with staving off the party crisis and reducing its dimensions when it finally arrived. The background of the present party crisis can be summarized in the following 5 points. 1. This party and its leadership have been under social pressures of such power, intensity, and unbroken continuity of duration as have never been withstood by any other revolutionary party in history. Beginning with the outbreak of the Second World War, nearly 14 years ago, this party had to stand up against all the pressures of patriotic fury and intolerance which the government, the labor bureaucracy, and the press could bring to bear. Two, the party had to fight for its revolutionary position in the trade union movement in Minneapolis against a united front of the AFL bureaucracy, the employers, the federal government, the Minnesota state government, the municipal police, a veritable army of imported gangsters, and the Stalins. The party had to suffer defeat and the sacrifice of its trade union positions in defense of its revolutionary principles and its intransigent opposition to the war. Three, the party had to stand up against the indictment, trial, conviction, and imprisonment of 18 of its leading people in the midst of the Second World War. Four, the party has had to maintain its revolutionary position and hold firm to its revolutionary perspective over an unbroken period of 13 years of war and post-war prosperity. 13 years. This unprecedented economic boom has operated not only to conservatize the general mass of the American working class, but has also exerted its conservatizing and corrupting influence directly upon a section of our own party. Five, during the past 6 years, the conservatizing and corrupting effects of sustained economic boom and prosperity have been supplemented by a reactionary witch hunt. This has brought the added pressure of intimidation to bear and has had its intended effects on the trade unions and in a certain measure on a section of our party. All this, in broad outline, is the background of the present internal struggle and the source of its true explanation. The Cochranites analyze the cause. Explanation. We see the conflict as the overdue and unavoidable result of the objective circumstances which I have enumerated. Their approach is more subjective. They see the party conflict as a calamity which might have been avoided, but has been artificially forced upon the party by the malevolent design of individuals. And their main concern is to fix the blame. Thus we are told, one, that the party leaders, with their inveterate factionalism and their abnormal and insatiable appetite for splits, provoke the struggle with the deliberate aim to make another split. And two, that the reason for this irrational conduct, I think they said irrational, didn't they, is an illness which has beset the party leadership. The name of this illness, they say, is Stalinophobia. Now, that is a very bad sickness indeed. Stalinophobia turns into social patriotism as blood poisoning turns into gangrene. And that's not all. Stalinophobia, as they tell it, has not broken out suddenly in the party. It has been raging in the leadership for a long time. And it has been determining their policy not since yesterday, not since last year even, but for years and years and years. From as far back at the latest report that I have seen as June 1940. That's party history as Cochrane writes it. Just why the Cochraneites stopped their historical excursions on that precise date of June 12, 15, 1940 is not clear. Perhaps their research is not completed yet. And perhaps further revelations are yet to come of our Stalinophobia and our factionalism. Certainly, I can inform them, if they don't know it, that there's plenty of evidence of our attitude towards Stalinism and our faction fights earlier than 1940. I personally have left a trail a mile wide on this subject for 25 years hand-running, ever since 1928. Look it up. I offer this information for the benefit and guidance. Shut the door, please. I offer this information for the benefit and guidance of those members of the Cochraneite research staff who may want to trace my factionalism and my hatred of Stalinism to their roots, for the roots are deep. Meantime, I would like permission to place on the table for examination now some historical exhibits which the Cochraneites have already introduced in evidence as proof of our Stalinophobia. Going back to June 12, 15, 1940, but so far not one day earlier. Party history is very important, but it ought to be written honestly. At one stage in the struggle of the left opposition in the Soviet Union, the struggle against the Stalinist degeneration, Trotsky found it necessary to take time out from the current political and ideological battle to restate, for the benefit of the Soviet youth, some of the true facts about the history of the party and the revolution, which had been buried under the mud and filth of Stalinist lies. This endeavor of Comrade Trotsky to inform the Soviet youth of the truth of their party history took shape in a classic document called the Stalinist School of Falsification. We published this work in the early days of our fight in this country, and many of our cadres were raised on it. It became a textbook for the education of our cadres and a mighty weapon in our fight against the Stalinist liars. To my great regret, I have to take time out now to perform the same task about the history of our own party, which is the heir and successor of the Bolshevik Party of Lenin and Trotsky, which has been the most faithful and consistent representative of the principles of Lenin and Trotsky, of any party in the whole world, and which, moreover, has recorded its own history more fully and more completely with documentary verification than any revolutionary party in the entire world. Our youth need to know the history of their own movement. They cannot learn to become Bolsheviks without studying this history, in which the basic principles have been demonstrated in action in their own country. We have to fight against the neglect and denigration of party history. And at this stage in our internal struggle, we have to take a little time out to fight against the falsification of that history. In the Stalinist revised version of the history of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, and virtually all of the authentic leaders of the party and the revolution, the old guard of Bolshevism, are depicted as counter-revolutionists who acted as agents of imperialism even during the revolution and the civil war, which they led and organized. That's the Stalinist version of the history of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. In the new and revised version of the history of our party, compiled by Cochran and his research staff, the leaders of our party, the old guard who founded the party, who have led and organized the struggle of the party against the petty bourgeois Stalinophobes, against the labor fakers, against the federal prosecutors and jailers, against the war and the Cold War and the witch hunt, these same leaders are depicted as nothing but Stalinophobes themselves. And thereby, here I quote literally from page 10 of The Roots of the Party Crisis, quote, a transmission belt for alien class influences into the party. The first exhibit in support of this framed indictment deals with our discussion of Comrade Trotsky in Mexico City on June 12, 15, 1940. Since I was a participant in that discussion, and since I am named in the indictment to which I plead not guilty, and since I am deeply determined that party history shall be told honestly and not falsified, I am taking this, the first occasion that has been offered to me, to tell the truth about that meeting and its aftermath. And if my speech is unduly long, I'll ask you to take that into consideration and bear with me, because this is the first chance I've had. I will summarize my comment, which I will later elaborate at length in writing in the internal bulletin, under a number of points, which I will enumerate slowly enough to be taken down and noted. Point one, the question of our tactics in the fight against Stalinism was raised by me in that discussion, as the rough stenogram shows. Because I wanted to bring out, in the presence of numerous other comrades present, the views of Comrade Trotsky in the hope that they might be helpful to us, as his opinions always had been. But Stalinism, as a political movement, was not the main item of our discussions with Comrade Trotsky on that occasion. And we had no fight with Trotsky about Stalinism. And we did not part as factional opponents as it is represented. We parted in agreement, friendship, and mutual confidence. Point two, the main topics of our political discussion with Comrade Trotsky on that occasion were the perspectives of the Second World War and America's part in it, the proletarian military policy, the strategy and tactics in the post-split struggle with the Shackmanites, the trade union question under war conditions, and the stabilizing influence of a central party leadership having close connections with the cadres in the field and enjoying their confidence. The discussion on some of these questions, which we had placed on the agenda, were recorded in rough stenogram for further study. Others were off the record. Still others, questions were discussed only in private conversations between Comrade Trotsky and me. Now, it is possible that I was mistaken, but I got the definite impression when we left Mexico City, the same impression that Trotsky had given me many times before, not only in words, but in actions which all could see, that he had the greatest confidence in the leading staff of our party. As I can testify over a period of 13 years of such collaboration, he was a loyal collaborator. He never stabbed us in the back. Point three. The main purpose of our visit, however, was not any one of these political discussions, nor all of them together. The main purpose of our visit in June 1940 to Mexico City was the question of the Stalinists, not as a political movement, but as a gang of terrorists and murderers. This charming characteristic of the Stalinists seems to have been forgotten lately, but we haven't forgotten it. Only a few weeks before, in the month of May, the Stalinists had staged an armed attack on Trotsky's household and made a determined attempt to assassinate him and Natalia. We in New York responded to that attack by reflex action. Comrade Dobbs and I made immediate preparations to go down there as soon as it was technically possible to check the situation and see what we could do for the protection of Comrade Trotsky's life. The main purpose of our visit was the discussion of a plan to fortify the house, to strengthen the guard, and to provide every possible physical and technical safeguard of the house. In the course of the discussions, we worked out and agreed upon a plan, And as soon as we returned to New York, we subordinated everything else to the not so easy task at that time of raising the thousands of dollars necessary to execute the plan of fortifying the house and increasing the guard. Point four. We did disagree with Comrade Trotsky about the proposal to give critical support to Browder in the election. I don't know whether we convinced him or not, but I do know that he did not insist on his proposal and told me in a personal conversation that he would not raise any part of the question of Stalinism as a political movement for discussion in the party at that time, and that he would leave it to the leadership to work out some kind of an approach to the Stalinist workers, who were far more numerous than they are now by united front tactics and so forth. Trotsky never gave us any orders on that occasion or any other. All the talk and all the chatter of the Shachmanites and the rest of our enemies about our movement being a mere personal appendage of Trotsky and about the leaders being mere jumping jacks who took orders and executed them without thinking, all that was false. There was not a trace of Cominternism in our relations with Comrade Trotsky in 13 years of loyal collaboration. Point five. The misleading introductory note to the stenogram of this discussion, published in Internal Bulletin Number 10, refers to it as a hitherto unpublished discussion with Leon Trotsky. A hitherto unpublished discussion, which is finally revealed to the party members 13 years later as a result of some marvelous research and detective work. Now that statement, that it's a hitherto unpublished discussion, I am sorry to say, is a misrepresentation of fact, which might give newer members of the party the false impression that the discussion was suppressed. That's not true. In the first place, the stenogram was not meant for publication. It was taken only at our request for further study and for the information of those members of the National Committee who had not been able to participate. In the second place, the suppressed stenogram was mimeographed and circulated to the members of the National Committee at the time. And thirdly, I made a full and honest report of the discussion to the combined plenum and active workers' conference at Chicago in October, 2 months later. A combined plenum and active workers' conference which was attended by nearly half the party membership. And that's not all either. My speech at the active workers' conference, incorporating this report and the resolution adopted by the convention on Stalinism and the United Front on the basis of my report of our talk with Trotsky, was published in the Socialist Appeal of October 19th, 1940. I repeat the date, October 19th, 1940. My speech reporting this discussion quite fully and completely honestly was published together with a resolution of the plenum conference. I intend to republish this speech and resolution in the internal bulletin in the further course of the discussion so that the young members of the party can read them and judge for themselves whether any opinions of Comrade Trotsky were suppressed and whether we had any real conflict with him on the question of Stalinism as a political movement. I'm going to republish this material. No matter how much time it takes, and here I make a promise to the party, no matter how much time it takes, and no matter what other important things have to be neglected, I am determined for my part that the history of our party shall be told straight and true. For to falsify party history means to poison the well from which the young party members have to drink. Point six. One has only to read my speech at the Plenum Active Workers' Conference to see that I gave a faithful account of the discussion with Trotsky, slurring over nothing and concealing nothing. I even mentioned my subsequent personal conversation with the old man about the matter. He told me, as I reported in my speech at the conference, that he would not make an issue or start a discussion about the question, because that wasn't the main question of our politics at that time, but did urge that we try to work out some kind of an approach to the Stalinist workers. He had raised that question earlier. That was no surprise. In his book, The In Defense of Marxism, you can see references to it in the articles he wrote, that we had to turn our attention to the Stalinist workers in their new turn. My conference speech, moreover, and the plenum resolution published at the time in the Socialist Appeal and the date I have given you, show that we did adopt a positive policy of united front and approach toward the Stalinist workers and came out for the defense of Browder and Bridges against the government prosecution.